Welcome to Live with Dan, your weekly live show, now in podcast format. I'm your host, Dan Fleetwood, President of Research and Insights here at Question Pro. This condensed and convenient audio experience captures the interviews from the live sessions and brings them directly to you. All right, let's get into it, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. So today we have Kristen Luck with us. I'm sure most of you know Kristen Luck. She's a pioneer in the research industry and also is founder of Scalehouse, president of SMR, so a number of different accomplishments and things that she's getting into. So really excited to have her join today. Let's bring her on.
Awesome. Hey, Kristen.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, Kristen, are you in Bend right now? Where are you at?
I just flew back last night. I've been on the road for 3 weeks. So I'm walking 5 days, I think, and then I'm off again.
Okay.
I don't know how many time zones I can cross in a 30-day period.
Yeah, I bet you pretty much cross them all. I know you're always in a lot of different things. I'm not sure how you do it, but I think you keep us all impressed.
Dan and I are both Pacific Northwesters, so Bend has a warm place in our heart. I lived in Portland for about 10 years, and Dan's from Seattle. So
yeah.
I'm like, ooh, anywhere I want to go. Like, Bend's like my lazy vacation, where I'm like, where does my soul feel happy?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing here, that's for sure. I feel really fortunate that I'm able to live here at least part of the time.
Yeah. You're like, when I'm there.
When I'm there, it's pretty blissful.
Awesome. Awesome. Let's dive into it. I know there's a wide-ranging conversation from AI to acquisitions to essentialism. So we're going to cover cover a little bit of everything here. I know. We're going into it. And Crystal scorns me every time because it's supposed to be 30 minutes, but I always end up going over
22 minutes.
We can do whatever we want here. So I guess, you know, let's start it off. Obviously, like the past 3 months, I think everybody's been inundated with AI, ChatGPT, and so forth and in every facet. So what I'd like to hear from you is, you know, what are like 2 to 3 things that get you excited about AI and market research? And I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think before diving into that, it's good to kind of just level set on what our definitions of AI are, because I feel like there's still a lot of confusion about like the difference between automation and AI. And we tend to confuse those terms pretty frequently. And there's also different types of AI. So I think just to kind of level set for this conversation, we are talking about artificial intelligence, not automation. Those are two very different things. And when we think about AI, there's 3 types that I'm really trying to educate myself on. The first is narrow AI, and that's probably the one we're most familiar with. And that is AI designed to perform really specific tasks. So Deep Blue for chess is a great example, or an app that is designed to do automatic translation. So to translate French into English, for instance. Yeah. That's an example of narrow AI. It's for one very specific purpose. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the one that we're the most familiar with at this point. Then there's general AI, and those are systems that can learn to be competent across pretty much any kind of task. It's more generalized in nature. And then there's artificial super AI, which is artificial super AI. those are systems that are really superior to humans. And when I talk about artificial super AI, I actually like to use the example of a calculator. Hmm. Your calculator is actually superhuman AI for math. And I think that people don't think of it that way, but it is. It's a lot more competent than humans. It can do things faster and more accurately than we can. And so it actually does fit that description, although most people would not think of a calculator as superhuman or artificial super AI. I believe that it really is. And if you talk to sort of any expert in the field of AI right now, they actually use that as a pretty common example.
That's what I'm going to calculator next time.
Yeah. When we're talking about in the context of research, I know there's been a lot of buzz lately about ChatGPT, for example. ChatGPT is general AI. Mm-hmm. It's not really great at anything yet.
Right.
It does a lot of things, but it doesn't do any of them really well. So for instance, if you gave it a 2 4-digit numbers and ask them to multiply them, it doesn't do it accurately most of the time. Like anything that involves carrying or large strings of numbers, and particularly with multiplication, doesn't do that well. AI is constantly a work in progress. It's learning. It's learning from what data is input into it and what people are feeding it. Mm-hmm. And so it's only as good as the information that it has. And so I think that's just kind of a watch out as people start to experiment with it. Like, you know, I use ChatGPT right now and almost daily basis. for folks that subscribe to my blog, my last three blog posts, I wrote in ChatGPT. I had to do a fair amount of editing to them. Right, right. You know, it takes me about an hour to write each blog post. It took me about 15 minutes this time. So it's a huge time saver, and it's great for very specific tasks, but because it's general AI, it's not really good at any one thing at this point. Mm. That's kind of a call out.
Yeah. Right, right. No, I think that makes sense. So I like that you're using it for tasks that would take you normally an hour, but you're using it for very specific reasons. So you're taking the general and making it specific to what you need.
I think
that's interesting application. So how do you think more people can utilize that in their job? Because I think there's this notion like, oh, AI is going to replace me, but I don't necessarily think that's true. I think it's a false statement. I'm
hopeful that AI is going to replace a lot more of the mundane tasks, you know, the tasks that are not really a value add. You know, when I think about how research and analytics have evolved over the years, like, and it's funny because I was in Los Angeles yesterday, actually, and I was having a chat with two researchers that I've known for most of my career. And we were talking about how when I first started out my career, we were like hand punching all the data, you know, these huge data cards, and you would take them and you would be manually analyzing that data or checking tabs offline. You know, my first job at Lieberman, which is now Material, you know, a common phrase there called PAPOing, which was proof against printout, which meant like every table that you were using in a report, you had to proof against the paper tabulations that you had. Lots of folks don't have to do that anymore. You can use an online reporting tool. It's a lot more efficient at mining through data, and it saves a ton of time. When I started my career, and I was actually still doing analysis, but I think that it is just about being selective about experimenting with some of these AI-driven solutions and figuring out what in essence saves you time and is trustworthy, and what are things that maybe look promising but aren't really where they need to be right now from an accuracy and reliability standpoint.
Right. Do you see, you know how like race car drivers are like, I have to learn how to drive before I drive a race car. Dan talks about like doing the old paper surveys a lot.
I think you're right, Crystal. I remember like, when I first started in research, one of my first jobs was like having to proofread crosstabs. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is terrible.
You guys have a different skill set than, let's say, you know, I know like, is someone coming in from a different timeline? Is you guys have a different skill set to proof what's right and wrong. Whereas someone coming, do you think that there's going to be a point where we may rely too much on those AI systems because you can't logic proof it against your traditional or your manual skill set? So there going to be a risk that it deteriorates the research or the insights?
I mean, I think this is where the difference between analysis and insights comes into play. When I think about utilizing AI, I think about utilizing a mind through large data sets or to aggregate multiple studies. I know kind of having these insights repositories down, which I know we're going to probably talk about in a few minutes. We have some back and forth on. Those are areas. If you've got multiple data sets coming from multiple places, like that's a great utilization of AI. However, I wouldn't rely on it to actually glean insights from that data. There's a human component, at least right now, to going through and you're doing a sense check on that data as well. And that's what I mean by not relying too heavily and understanding that there's limitations. I mean, a really good example too, as it results to AI, is that we've been writing tax code for over 6,000 years and people still find loopholes in it. So I think just saying that we're going to inherently trust AI for everything is maybe that we're far off from there. I mean, I think I don't have children. I have dogs, but I think certainly within the lifetime of most folks' kids, there'll be more general AI applications, but I would say probably during the span of my remaining career, which hopefully will not be indefinite, although it might. I don't think we're going to get to that general AI promise feel like makes a lot of folks in research nervous. And Dan, I think to your point, I don't think AI is a replacement for thoughtful analysis and like really getting to what the insights are. I think that takes a different level of thoughtfulness. And that's where the value really comes. Researchers are like, I don't really look at it as a threat. I look at it as, thank God, how much time are we going to save by not having to do these more mundane low value tasks, but the fact that we get to really focus on what I would consider to be the more enjoyable parts of the research process.
Right, right. So I think it's more
of my enjoy list.
No, 100%. It's embracing it and using it to your advantage, I think, is the biggest thing, right? I mean, AI can be like the cure-all for a lot of people, right? Like it's going to save us. But what are some traps or gotchas that you can think about that people should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly, and I've written about this a bit, that again, the algorithm is only as good as what goes into it. And so there are certainly issues with bias that gets learned as part of the code. And there's been a lot of that again in the news, again, particularly around the ChatGPT integrations that Microsoft has done into Bing and some of the questionable conversations that have come. I also think it's important, to your point, to get to more reliable AI because there can be major consequences. For instance, if you put in a medical question and it spit out the wrong answer and somebody died because they mistreated themselves based on everybody's a doctor these days. Everybody's mining around on the internet. But if you, know, if you went in and asked ChatGPT for a medical solution and they gave you the wrong one, it has really dire consequences. And I think another good example of that is social media. When you think about YouTube videos are based on an algorithm that's learning from what you watch and then it's recommending things. And the whole point is that it's trying to get you to watch, because the ad model for the internet, well, I guess the revenue model for the internet is based on ads that you watch. Right. And so, of course, it benefits YouTube to have you watch as many videos in a row and send you down that rabbit hole of little puppy videos or whatever it is that you're watching online, which meets their goal of engagement, but it's not in the best interest of the users.
Right.
So those are the sort of the watch outs, which is, are you getting misinformation? Are the benefits you're getting not really aligned to the user versus the company? Is it creating an atmosphere where certain groups are being marginalized or there's further bias being introduced because the folks creating the algorithms or who are inputting the data sets are using biased data?
No, I think that's interesting. And it kind of reminds me of even the article I was reading recently around Elon Musk even said, hey, let's kind of slow it down here a little bit on, you know, kind of developing GPT-4 because ethical reasons. And I mean, there might be other reasons why you mentioned it too.
Elon saying slow it down. I feel like that's
I know, that's what I was thinking too, but it wasn't a
fan, but I was not only surprised, but like sort of pleasantly surprised to hear that he said that. Although to Kristen's point, I think there's probably an ulterior motive. I don't really see him as the most altruistic.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. Clearly, I think that's an ulterior
motive. His value since he bought it.
He has the best interest of the user at heart.
Yeah. Right. All right. Why don't we switch gears here and talk about Insights Repositories? So Insights Repositories, I think, kind of relatively new in the research space. So I think, what are your broad thoughts on them? And kind of a side question is, are they being adopted enough by companies? And love to get your thoughts there.
I think larger companies, for sure, where they've got a lot of data coming in. You know, if you look at big companies like Pepsi and Coca-Cola, they all have big data repositories. I think that it's something that smaller firms are, and when I say smaller, I mean not the Fortune 50, are starting to get on board with for a number of reasons. One, there is a ton of waste in insights. And, you know, if you ever spend any time talking to Christy Zolke, who founded Knowledge Hound, one of the reasons that she created Knowledge Hound was based on the amount of waste data that she found in her roles at P&G.
Yeah.
I think particularly as your organization grows and gets broader and broader and broader, making sure that you do have one centralized place for data becomes very important, particularly when you're using other data sources too. So if you're using point of sale data or CRM data, other non-research related data sources, of course, having access to all of those in one place becomes really important. And then I think another big motivator for firms is the fact that Google cookies are going away and they are having to really think about, well, what does that mean, particularly around user data? How can I store and access user data more efficiently? And that's what's, I think, interesting about it is, I think, I can't remember what year folks started talking about communities, but, you know, C-Space, I think, was launched around the same year that I launched my first company back in 2000. Yeah, and communities are having a huge resurgence right now, which is really ironic. So everything old is new again.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think it's right. I think that's right.
I know that this is, you know, we try to keep it thought leadership, but don't forget, this is my plug. Dan won't do it because Dan's good at his job. I'm in marketing. I got it. Make sure you check out our Insights Hub, which is an insights repository by Question Pro, and communities, which Dan is in charge of.
Yeah.
And it's like Question Pro's best kept secret that shouldn't be a secret.
Yeah. favorite. I use you guys all the time as an example of amazing SEO. you are watching, if you've not ever Google searched on any market research term, chances are Question Pro is going to come up at the top of the list. It's absolutely amazing. And there is literally nothing more valuable than organic search. So I know, Crystal, this probably preceded your time with the company because it's been going on for a while. I mean, I've been using you guys as an example for years, but it's a great example of using thought leadership and data to drive brand awareness. Yeah.
No, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, they'll definitely appreciate that. I know it was a big focus early on, and yeah. I've been here a long time. It's always been a focus since I've been here. So
yeah, it's just funny because I do a lot of SEO audits, and every time I search on the term,
you're like, a question for there.
Of course,
they are.
Yeah, there they are again. Yeah.
Here we are. Don't mind us.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. We talked about AI insights repositories. What are you excited about in the MRX industry over the next couple of years? Anything else that kind of gets you excited and where your mind is at?
And, you know, communities for sure, I think, are super important and are of growing importance. That to me, and I know that, again, that sounds funny to be excited about it 20 years after we first started doing insight communities, but I also think they've evolved and changed quite a bit. I think one of the best things to come out of the pandemic, I think, has been just an increased focus on automation and utilizing technology more efficiently to conduct research. I think there were probably more resistance to that before. You know, we tend to be a more traditional bunch.
Yes, I would say that's true.
Yeah. Lisa Wilding Brown and I were joking at the end of last year when somebody was talking about how this year, 2023, was going to be the year of mobile. And I was like, we were literally saying that in 2008.
Yeah.
2008. Yeah. It cannot be the year of mobile for like 15 years. So,
that's so true.
Yeah, I think the utilization of AI, particularly as it relates to data mining and a lot of the data automation around that and how that relates to insights repositories, those I think are things that are going to provide real value adds, and particularly on the client side. I think one of the big opportunities for researchers, and I've been saying this for a few years now, is that we really have to get more comfortable with working with data that is not coming from primary research, area where we still struggle. Mm-hmm. And I think we just need to get a lot smarter about how to do that and the best tools, platforms, methods, and strategies. And I think the more thought leadership and the more knowledge sharing we have around that, I think the better the industry will be overall.
Yeah.
Do you think a lot of that comes from like researchers wanting to use like their own methods and their ways are the best, and they want to have 100% certainty that it's done right, so they want to do it themselves? Or do you think it's other reasons that they're not using more secondary data?
I think one is the business models that we've created, and particularly in some of the larger firms, it's problematic to the business model. But I also think that we do have a tendency to shy away from data that we have not collected ourselves and to perceive it as being less reliable, which I actually don't think that is the case at all. For instance, if you look at behavioral data, behavioral data is passively collected. It's much more reliable than self-reported data.
Mm.
So I think more of it has to do with really not understanding how to combine disparate data sets, and that really still being a struggle, and not having a lot of great tools to do that. There was a talk that Pavi Gupta, who's the, I think he's the head of research now at SC Johnson, gave at a TMRE event a few years ago. And it was about basically like how he'd had to figure out on his own, because there was no supplier or research provider that he could get to do it for him, but really creating this kind of ecosystem that he developed for how he does bring in all of these different forms of data. It was a short talk, but I almost felt like it was a masterclass in how to accomplish that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, he's definitely lived it, right? And like he needed this.
Yeah. You know, he tells this very compelling story. It was when he was at Johnson & Johnson, and he went and gave this big data presentation. And afterwards, the CMO came into his office and said, hey, that was great, but what about like our CRM data? What about our point of sale data? And Pop was like, I'm a researcher. I don't work with anything like that. And he said the CMO just kind of looked at him and left his office. And Pavi was like, I realized I was not going to have a job a year from now if I didn't figure this out. And I think, unfortunately, in this industry, that's what it comes down to a lot of the time. And behavioral change is hard for all of us, but I think case in point, qualitative research in the pandemic, there's always been a lot of resistance to using technology for qualitative research. And I understand why, but I thought it was magical how 80% of qualitative magically moved online during the pandemic. All of a sudden it wasn't so bad after all.
When you could I know. No, it's so true. It's so true, because even during the pandemic, I mean, we released video discussions and things like that because it was a necessity. But I agree with you that the pandemic really helps kind of push a lot of the industry forward in terms of methodologies and things they were using. So yeah. If there's anything that good that came out of it, that's one of them for sure.
I learned to cook. So I feel like that was my...
Hey, that's great. Yeah.
That was my there you go.
Yeah.
Awesome. So let's move on to like more of the acquisition, kind of the business side of the research. So obviously, I think we all know that a lot of money has been pumped into the research industry over the last several years and probably even beyond that. Curious to get your take around, you know, two recent, I guess, things that happened with Qualtrics and SurveyMonkey or Momentive both being taken private. So what do you think about that? And then should we still be optimistic about the investment coming in? Love to get your take on that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that there's a little more skepticism and nervousness around investing in companies that are not trying to profit.
Right.
So technology platforms that maybe are growing really rapidly and are demonstrating a lot of revenue, but aren't at a point of profitability. I mean, Qualtrics, I think just in the last year has become profitable, and Momentive, profitable. But if you look at the multiple that they received, it was really, I think it was 3x. Yeah. So it was, you know, having getting a 3x multiple on a tech platform, I think there's been this belief in this industry, and I try to dismantle this belief whenever I hear it, but there's been this belief that you can't really monetize a business in a meaningful way unless you have a tech platform. And I don't think that's the case at all. And that's not been my experience at all. Someone that now works in M&A quite heavily in this industry. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is more pressure on tech companies to be profitable, or at least to be able to show a path to profitability than there has been in recent years. And I also think multiples are sort of at the bottom right now, or at least I'm hoping at the bottom for tech platforms that are going to bounce back. Dan, I think to your point, there is a tremendous amount of investment still coming into this industry. And 2022 was another banner year. So I would expect that we would still see many, many deals and large, significant deals coming through, much like the Qualtrics and the Momentives of the world.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting points. And you're right. I mean, a lot happened in 2022 with acquisitions and mergers and everything. Yes, so it's amazing when you think back. Yeah.
Yeah. There's stuff going on a wild ride on the Swedish Stock Exchange as well. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's interesting to hear your point because obviously you live it kind of every day at Scale House and so forth. So
I think, you know, overall valuations are still really strong. I think there's still a lot of debate about, are we going into recession? Are we in a recession? Have we been in a recession? Are we coming out of a recession? The problem is that we have a lot of the indicators are contradictory to what we normally see. And so I think there are some businesses that are really flourishing right now and some that are struggling. And a lot of that just depends on your customer concentration and your client base and your positioning. What I will say is I do think that the days of research generalists, so folks that are trying to be all things to all people, I think those are the firms that are really struggling more so than others. And if you look at data related to industry growth, most of the growth is coming from specialists. It's not coming from generalists. They're taking market share from generalists every day. So
that's a good point.
Specialization is key. I know it feels counterintuitive to a lot of people, but specialization is really important.
Yeah, plus it helps you stand out too, right? So that's a big component. Maybe we should all agree that we're not in a recession and then we can just move on.
I don't believe that we're in a recession. I think we had some rocky moments in the last year for sure. But to me, it does not feel like we're in a recession. And most of the companies that I'm working with right now, and of course, I do a lot of pre-M&A optimization, they're performing quite well. And they're growing and getting new clients and customer base is expanding. So again, I think a lot of it has to do with your positioning and how you present yourself out in the industry.
True. No, that's a great point. We have about a minute left here, Crystal, so I'll try to stay on time, okay?
Not really fast now.
No, feel free. There's no rules. There's no rules. We can do whatever we want.
Crystal's going to quit that.
I'm just going to turn it off. Be like, bye.
No. Yeah, right? You just end it.
Right? You're going like, 1 minute.
Obviously, you know, conference season is among us. There's been a couple conferences already this year. I know you wrote an article around, hey, if you're going to a conference, these are some things that you should look out for, how to make your experience memorable. So can you share some of those? What are some tips you have for people, you know, kind of going to a conference and wanting to make the most out of it?
Yeah, I love going to conferences and seeing all my industry friends, but in general, it's not the best use of marketing investment for most people. If you're bound and determined to go to an event and you want to exhibit and get ROI out of that event, I do have a conference playbook that I've shared on my blog a few times. I think the key is to go in with a plan. And I think what's interesting in this industry in particular is that folks that are in market research are literally the worst at both marketing and measuring their own performance.
Story of my life with these guys.
Mark marketing ROI is like a black box. Nobody wants to invest anything in marketing. Nobody wants to invest in brand building. And conferences are generally, if you look at marketing metrics, they're one of the worst converting activities and the most expensive that you can have. I would never spend more than 20% of my budget on events, first of all. Mm-hmm. Secondly, if you want to go into an event with a plan, and when I say a plan, I mean a pre-event plan. So how are you going to market your attendance at that event, and how are you going to set up meetings in advance? Mm-hmm. Second is, what's your plan when you're on site? So who are you sending? What's the expectation at the event? Mm-hmm. How many leads are you trying to generate a day? How are you best going to convert those leads? And then the third is, what are you doing after the event? You could have a marketing campaign all set up and ready to roll post-event. I mean, I think one of the most challenging things, certainly for marketers, and Crystal, I'm sure you're going to identify with this one, is when you've got a sales team that goes to an event, they generate a bunch of leads, and then nobody ever follows up on them.
Or they take marketing.
Crystal, that never happens. Come on.
I was working for a firm a few years ago, and we, at the beginning of the year, we sort of looked back at all the leads that were generated, and they had over 400 leads that they generated from events that had never been touched after the event.
Whoa.
Never.
I would have rioted.
Yeah. I would say invest in good marketing, invest in data-driven marketing. We're a data-driven industry, but we do not use data to tune our own business performance a lot of the time. And that's super important. Yeah, sure. It's great to go to an event and have a good time and see your friends. But also remember, less than 1% of the industry goes to events. A very small subset. You know, be judicious with your time and make sure that you're sending folks that are really take the event seriously and be productive, and that they understand why they're attending.
That's crazy. Less than 1% of the
industry goes. Less than 1%. If you really have a strategy around events and the people that are working them are really diligent, you can get a higher conversion rate than that. But that's the average. It's 1%.
Wow.
Yeah. As a pair compared to organic search, which converts at almost 14-15%.
Right.
We've
right.
got that on lockdown. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I think we can probably end it. I'll end it on time here today for you.
Oh, so, not even on time.
Oh, that's close enough. There's a range that we can end on. So it's
it's a rounding error.
It's a margin of error, right? That's what we
have. It's AI and it didn't carry.
Yeah, there we go.
Two things. If you want to sign up for Kristen's newsletter, we have dropped that in the comments section. Make sure you sign up for Kristen's newsletter. It sounds like there's a lot of good nuggets in there. Thank you, Kristen, for closing out our Women's History Month and our Season 3. You can find us back here, TBD.
Okay, fair enough.
TBD. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Kristen. Appreciate
Bye,
it.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for tuning in to Live with Dan. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe and be sure to catch us next time. Until then, this is Dan signing off.